Hello and welcome to Weird. I'm Katie, a science writer.
And I'm Amy, a nurse.
We're cousins and we have an unhealthy obsession with the bizarre side of science.
This is Weird, the podcast.
We're glad you're listening in today. This is Weird, the podcast, where we take a nosedive into the wacky parts of the world.
We each have an odd science topic that we've researched, so we will start by flipping a coin to see who presents first. And again, the coin is on my phone because yes, we don't have real money anymore. Okay, it's tails.
My topic today is something that I think anyone who lives in our area of Colorado has experienced a lot. And I guess we should say disclaimer, if you hear random eerie noises coming from Amy's side, it is her adorable dogs that are making their appearance. So we're not just like breathing heavy into your ears. So it's just a little bit of doggy ASMR in the background. So you're welcome. So my topic today is about the Miller moth migration. So it actually is a migration, and that's why we get this influx of moths here this time of year. And so I don't know if there's other types of moth migrations in other areas, or if this moth is also common in, like, you know, all over the US or even in the world. But for anyone listening here in Colorado, or maybe if you're not from Colorado, you know, let us know. All of you seven listeners are not here in Colorado. Every early summer here in Colorado, at least here in sort of the, you know, Denver metro area where I am, and more northern Colorado where Amy is, we get all these moths, and they are the Miller moth. It's pretty much the most classic looking moth you can think of, like a little creepy looking. They have long legs and they sort of have whitish brown wings, and they flutter around.
They're very basic moth.
They're not so basic though in their other anatomy, which I'll get into, but they, in the spring, in like late spring, early summer, suddenly, and it's like, it makes the news around here where there's just so many of them. So like you'll go to your garage, or like you'll go, like, you know, to your backyard or something, and they'll just be like hundreds of these like little moths that just like are fluttering around, and it doesn't last very long. It only lasts for like a few weeks max. And so I think a lot of people assume that they like are hatching or something, you know, and that's why they're suddenly everywhere, but they're not. None of them were born here in this area of Colorado. They all flew from hundreds and hundreds of miles or more away. They are not so basic when it comes to their activity here. So basically, the kind of interesting and unusual life cycle of the Miller moth, which is they're the adult version of a caterpillar called the army cutworm. And so before I dug into this more, I wasn't fully aware of the fact that like they really aren't in the caterpillar stage in this area of Colorado at all. It's just the adult, which is why I never really see these caterpillars, but then suddenly, you know, there's a bunch of moths around. So their life cycle basically and of course I have to kind of pick a part of the cycle to start, but it is all, you know, a continuous generational cycle year to year. So in like the late summer, early fall, the adult moths will lay eggs. And this happens in the eastern plains of Colorado and in the high plains of the US. So this is like Montana, Wyoming, parts of Kansas, Oklahoma. And those little eggs, they will hatch, obviously, into caterpillars, into the army cutworm caterpillar. And they will live as partially grown caterpillars through the fall. So they don't mature super quickly. They kind of like gradually mature through the fall and through the winter. And so they sort of are like alive during dog ASMR. They're alive. He really wants to learn about the Miller moth. Like he's just trying to contribute.
He's just participating.
He's just really participating. So the caterpillars here, they don't really like hibernate or anything during those more winter months. They kind of slowly grow over the winter, and they are considered a nuisance over there. And like, you know, there's a lot of farm country, obviously, in the high plains. And so they do eat like crops like wheat and like alfalfa and stuff. So a lot of farmers don't like them. But what happens is they finally form into their cocoons, into their pupa stage in like the early spring. And they are in that stage underground usually for about a month, and then they all hatch in the early spring. And then they start this whirlwind adventure to come to the Rocky Mountains for vacation. And it truly is, they're not coming here to mate or to do anything other than like be in a more comfortable temperature and like enjoy the Rocky Mountain scenery and the flowers specifically.
It is pretty nice.
So it is, yeah. It's like a nice little mountain retreat. Interestingly, like a lot of insects and other types of creatures, they migrate to a different place, you know, because they want to reproduce there. So, you know, a lot of other, like, I believe, and maybe I should have double checked this, but I think some of the butterfly migrations, like, and some of the other types of migrating, like birds and stuff, they will, you know, migrate to warmer areas and they will usually mate there, lay eggs there, you know, like have their babies there, but not the Miller moth. So what happens is they hatch in the plains, you know, way east of where we are here in Colorado, and then they will start flying, and they will fly hundreds of miles, these little moths, to get to the, like, the really the actual mountains. So I think a lot of people who are not from Colorado think that we all just live in the mountains, but that is definitely not true. We, you know, I forget that we live in like a mountainous state half the time. Unless I'm trying to navigate, then you always have to look to the mountains, and that's how you know where west is, for those of you listening that are not in Colorado.
Yeah, the mountains are the west.
Exactly. So we don't live in like this like cold, snowy, like mountainous place. You know, it's a pretty mild temperature here in Denver or in Northern Colorado where Amy is. So basically, I mean,
today was hot as fuck.
That's true. It was hot. It was so hot today. And my office in Denver is an old building and it was like 80 degrees in my office and I died. Yeah. So it was not super fun. So maybe we will see less Miller moths, because actually it's very seasonal, because they stick around only temporarily where we live in Colorado, because we are not their destination. The Denver area, the Longmont, Loveland area, you know, like all these like places where most of the people live here in Colorado, that's not where they're trying to get to. They are trying to get to like the mountains, because they need that really cool weather. We're just a stop on their little road trip. Or I guess it's not a road trip. I guess it's an air trip. So it's a little fly trip.
A little fly trip.
So we're just a stop on the trip. So, you know, be nice if you see these little Miller moths. Like, they don't mean any harm. They don't bite. They're not poisonous to, you know, cats and dogs who might try to eat them, and I've definitely seen that happen. You don't have to worry about them. They obviously can get kind of annoying if they get in your house and they're fluttering around at night and trying to land on you, but it is very temporary. So why are they going to the mountains? Why do they risk their lives and, you know, get up and move and fly hundreds of miles across the state if they're not even going there to mate or to do anything else? Basically, they are very temperature dependent. So they need like a very specific temperature range. And typically that's sort of, you know, a cooler temperature. You know, they like it in the 60s. They don't really like it if it gets too hot. And they just can't really find that anywhere but the Rocky Mountains. So that's why they go to the mountains. And they obviously can't fly that entire distance in one day. So they have to do it several miles each day. And they just take a little rest in our backyards and in our garages. But once they get up to the mountains, they actually go into this, and this is actually one of the cooler facts. So like I mentioned, they're not going there to mate. They're not going there to lay their eggs. They really are like vacationing there, because it's like the perfect temperature. And there's lots of like mountain wildflowers, because they are pollinators, which is why, another reason why you shouldn't kill them, because they do help pollinate all of our flowers in our gardens here. And so what they do when they get to the mountains is they reach a specific physiological state. It's called diapause. So this is a very specific evolutionary reproductive state where they're sort of in like a state of dormancy. So this can happen in different types of animals. It can happen in some insects. It can even happen like in mammals too, I believe. But it's like a delay in development in response to environmental conditions, or an evolutionary response to animals that have to migrate long distances. So they're like pausing there. They don't really grow. They don't go into mating mode. They don't go into egg laying mode. They're literally just on vacation in the mountains.
And, so they go into the mountains specifically, and then they have this little diapause. diapause, but diapause phase where they just hang out basically.
Just chill and take like a summer Rocky Mountain vacation, and they just like have a bunch of flower nectar and they enjoy the nice cool temperatures. And then, you know, after a full summer of doing that in like the like late summer, early fall, they fly back to the high plains. They fly back to like Montana, Oklahoma, Wyoming, all across. They do the whole journey all the way back again. So they did that whole journey literally just to hang out in this like ideal temperature and, you know, have lots of flowers. And then they go back. And obviously there's a lot less moths going back, migrating back to where they are going to eventually, you know, they go back and they lay their eggs way east from Colorado. But, you know, a lot of them died during the migration up to the mountains. Obviously some die over the summer. Actually, a lot of them die over the summer. So here's the kind of cute and fascinating reasons why a lot of them don't migrate all the way back to eventually mate and lay eggs. So they are a good food source for a lot of animals that live in the mountains. So birds love to eat these moths. My cat loves to eat them. Amy, I'm sure your pets have eaten many a moth over the years.
Yes, definitely eats moths for sure.
Yes, definitely. But up in the mountains where we have grizzly bears and stuff, that's one of their favorite foods. So when the bears are like trying to fatten up, you know, like all summer and into the early fall, they're, you know, really trying to fatten up and get ready for hibernation. Moths are very fatty. Allegedly. I've never tried one personally, but apparently they're very fatty and nutritious.
Sorry, and
yes. Yeah. Sorry, moth. grizzly bears apparently love to eat moths, and they can like, they know where to find them because bears are pretty smart, you know, and they will look under rocks and under, you know, because they like to hide during the day in cooler areas. And they can, I don't know if this is true. This is just, you know, one of the facts I've found with some searching. They can eat up to like 40,000 moths in a day if they're like really hunting.
I was literally just thinking, like, how many moths would it take to sustain something as gigantic as a grizzly bear? Like, yeah, that's a shitload of moths.
I know. And again, I doubt this, I forget where I found that fact. So I'm not positive if that's 100% correct, but that seems about right. A bear would need to eat quite a bit to, you know, get fat enough for the winter. And obviously that's not the only food source. Bears also eat a lot of, you know, fish and berries, and they, you know, eat all sorts of things up there. But yeah, I thought that was, I didn't know that they ate moths. And I mean, it kind of makes sense because they're good foragers, and especially if they're high in fat, like that's what the bears need.
Actually 40,000 moths, like, is that like in one day? Like 40,000 moths a day?
Eat that many in a single day.
That actually seems like, I would think that it would be more, actually.
Because
grizzly bears are like massive. I mean, they're like,
thousands of
moths. Moths are like so small.
Wing too. I feel like the fatty part of a moth, I assume, is like their organs and their abdomen. Like, I feel like the wings are just crunchy. Yeah.
Just a little
appetizer.
A little textural element.
Yes, exactly. But actually, so I was doing some more research on like, why are they called Miller moths? Cause I'm like, that's a weird name. Like, is it discovered by a guy named Miller? It's not. So they get their name, the Miller moth, because they sort of look like they have a white powdery kind of substance on the outside of their wing. Most moths do have that sort of powdery look. And if you touch a moth, a lot of times you will get a little bit of almost like flowery looking coating. And that's why they're called Miller moths, because of like flour mills. And like people thought it looked like you had been working in a flour mill if you touched a Miller moth. So that's where they get the name. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
That is really interesting.
So then I went on a little mini deep dive into like, well, why? Like, why are moths covered in like a dusty substance? Like, there's got to be like some sort of scientific explanation or like evolutionary reason why they're like have this dusty appearance. So it's their scales. So they're, if you look at a moth wing or a butterfly wing, like under a magnifying glass, or I guess maybe you need a microscope to see that small, but it's like tiny, tiny little scales, thousands, millions probably of little tiny scales. And they have a lot of different purposes. So they
on their wings, they have scales?
Yeah. So all like, and even like, I mean, obviously I try not to like, you know, harm butterflies, but like if you were to touch a butterfly wing or a moth wing, you know, and rub your finger in there and then look at your finger, it would just all come off. Like they're little, they're scales, but they're not attached by much because, you know, their wings need to be so light and delicate. Right. So that powdery substance are tiny, tiny scales on their wings. So they're like little dragons.
They are like little dragons.
Sea dragons that bears like to eat.
That's so cool.
tiny little microscopic scales. And see, I jotted down a couple things that like these scales do. So not only does that sort of allow moths and butterflies to have really intricate patterns and colors on their wings, because like you're talking about, like they are microscopic scales, so much so that they look like dust if they get on your hand. So like because of that, they can really be arranged in a way to make all these like cool patterns and stuff on the wings of these insects. And they help them thermoregulate. So they can reflect the sun and absorb heat in very specific ways because of the way that they're structured. They make the wing more aerodynamic, so it helps in flight. They obviously serve like a layer of like protection from the elements and can help waterproof their wings as well because of the way these scales are set up. So I feel like most people wouldn't do a deep dive into why, you know, they would just take it at face value. Oh, they're called Miller moths because they look like they you were in a flour mill. Nope, I took several minutes and did a deep dive to why they look like that. So now we all know, in case everyone was just dying to know.
It was just dying to know. It's because they have scales.
Yeah, isn't that cool?
Because like moths and butterflies have scales.
It's like, I know.
That blows my mind.
I know, isn't that crazy? So many things have scales that we had no idea. So yeah, so I thought that was interesting. Oh, so, you know, I mentioned, you know, a lot of animals like to eat the moths. But I think a lot of, I don't know if this happens in other places, but I've definitely seen at like, a lot of times at like a intersection where there's a bunch of cars waiting for the light to turn green. A lot of times I will look up and there's all these like swallows and birds like diving and like, you know, trying to get all these bugs.
Yeah.
Apparently, and the Miller moth is a good, you know, food source for a lot of these birds that you do see displaying this behavior. And apparently that phenomenon typically happens because the moths like to hide in cars during the day because they're like seeking shelter. And a lot of times when you stop at a red light, then like some moths will fly out or whatever. Mm. And the birds are smart enough that they have that figured out. And so they will typically like wait near a place where cars are about to start and the, you know, spook the moth. And the moths fly out. And so the birds are sort of waiting for like moths to fly out of your car.
Wow.
So yeah, so I thought that was interesting too. And they a lot of times those moths are like wounded when they come out of the car because, you know, it's not a great place for a moth. And the birds know that too. And so they're like, ooh, buffet time. Like
yum, the moths
are about to like come out of all these cars. So
the injured moths coming out of the cars.
You know, delicious. Injured moths.
Yeah.
with me being an exception, most people don't really like bugs, you know, too much. And they don't really like, you know, bugs flying around near them at night. And so I get it, you know, they're annoying, but try not to kill them. And then I found a couple tips that can help, you know, kind of ward them away from your house. So one of them is sound. So they use like very specific like types of hearing organs in their thorax, like in their chest. They have like tympanal, I don't know how to say that, organs that are like in their body cavity.
Yeah, like tympanal, like your tympanic membrane. It's like your tympanic membrane in your ear, which is essentially your eardrum. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's not in their head. It's like in their thorax.
So they have they have eardrums in their abdomen.
Yes. Underneath all their skulls.
So weird.
Yeah, isn't that weird? Like, and so they can, I don't know if it's officially echolocation, but it's similar to that. Like, you know, they can use this sort of like vibrational sensory organs to hear and to navigate. Because obviously this takes a lot of navigation, what they're doing with this migration pattern. They're migrating hundreds of miles across, you know, multiple states. So, you know, like they really do need a good way to navigate, and sound is one of those. Mm-hmm. And so they typically steer clear of areas that are really loud and have especially like higher vibrational sounds. So apparently wind chimes is like a really good way to make sure that they don't get near your house, because the high pitched pinging of wind chimes, they don't like it. So they will, you know, go to someone else's house that does wind chimes. So yeah, I thought that was interesting that because I looked that I heard that little tip that you know, wind chimes can help alleviate moths from kind of parking at your house too much. And like,
yeah,
oh, but why? Like, but yeah, it's because they have eardrums in their chest cavity that they use for echolocation, and it messes it up.
Fascinating.
So there's one tip for you. And then another one is to eliminate like your porch lights and stuff. Like they're attracted to light. They think it's the moon. They also use it for navigation. So a lot of these are just, you know, like they're very attuned to their navigation because of, you know, they're in the middle of a migration. So they have to be. And apparently the moth has, they have like compound eyes that are look like their actual eyes, but they also have these other like more simple small eyes called ocelli, O-C-E-L-L-I, and they're looking at the top of their heads. They look straight up, and that's how they sense the light, and they think it's the moon, and that's how they know kind of where they're oriented, and that's how they navigate. So when you have a big old porch light or street light or whatever, they get really confused, and that's why they like flock towards it, and they, you know, like they start fluttering around. So, you know, they don't mean any harm. They're just confused. They got eyes on the top of their head. They got eardrums in their chest. They're covered in scales. And, you know, they're about to get eaten by a bear, and they just went on vacation in the mountains. That's all they're trying to do.
Moths are just like a friggin' mess, man.
I know. Moths. But also, like, same. I get it, you know? I also feel disoriented and want to go on vacation in the mountains all summer. Yeah, so I get it.
I really can't argue with that, so...
Yep. I think that's mainly what I have. I mean, I guess the other footnote is their populations do fluctuate a lot year to year, and that's specifically because of how long this like kind of cool period is right before the summer hits. So like I mentioned, we in this area of Colorado that's like Denver and, you know, Longmont Boulder, we're just a pit stop to their ultimate destination. Mm-hmm. So if it gets too hot too early, they don't want to stick around, so they'll keep going. But if it is a little bit cooler during the early summer, they'll stick around longer. So that's why some years they stick around for a lot longer, and sometimes it's a lot shorter. So maybe we won't have a super long moth season this month because, yeah, it was too hot today. It was
I actually feel like this year, I haven't seen as many this year mm-hmm. as I have in previous years. Like sometimes, like, because I kind of live like out in the country where like, there's mm-hmm. shitloads of bugs of all kinds. And I remember last year it was like, oh my God, there's so many fucking moths. Like they were just like all of like, I would open the front door and they would just be like on the wall. Just like hundreds of them. And I haven't noticed
there's so many.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've only seen a couple. Like there's one in my house a few days ago. I saw like three in the backyard a couple days ago. Granted, maybe we're just not quite there yet because it can sort of happen during May and June. And, you know, again, the mm-hmm. timing fluctuates depending on the seasonality and the weather, you know, patterns of that year. But so I think it's just something that, you know, a lot of us here in Colorado just kind of know like, oh, yeah, there's a lot of moths in the spring. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't know how many people know that it's not that they're just like all hatching in the spring or something. In
that's
fact,
what I
they
always thought.
A long time ago, they flew here. They came specifically here because they need a vacation.
They are trying to go on vacation.
Yeah.
You know what? I feel that. I'm trying to go on vacation too.
I know. Yeah. Same. Same Miller moths. Same. Oh, one other fact that I forgot to say is they, you know, I mentioned they're good pollinators, which is one of the obviously reasons, apart from they, you know, are bear snacks, that you shouldn't kill these moths. They pollinate just like butterflies pollinate, just like bees pollinate, or hummingbirds, or all these other pollinators. But specifically, I think a lot of people realize that like during the day is when most bees and butterflies and birds, you know, pollinate the flowers. But some flowers open more at night versus the day. I don't know exactly which flowers, but the flowers that bloom more in the evening, the moths pollinate those much more than the butterflies do. So a lot of the species of flowers that bloom in the cooler times of the day really depend on these moths because the butterflies just aren't awake when they need to be pollinated. So resist the urge to kill all the moths.
Yeah.
Just put them aside, you know, turn off your porch light. They'll go somewhere else and they'll be on their way.
Get some wind chimes.
Get some wind chimes and, you know, don't hurt the poor little moths. Just shoo them outside. You'll be fine.
They are really annoying though, a lot of the times. Like
they are.
It's like, it's so freaky when you like open your door at night and just like a moth just, like flies directly into your face and you're like, like that is really unnerving.
I did also read during my research here that there's a reason why they fly so like crazily. Like they're not very you know, coordinated when they fly, and that is actually, they specifically do that to try to like not get eaten by things. Like that they're the last ditch effort to like, you know when you're like trying to run from an alligator and you're supposed to run in a zigzag,
as we all like are at some point during the day.
Yes, as we all are. Everyone runs from alligators
during the day
in the middle of Colorado. Yeah, well, there's so many alligators here in Colorado.
My daily run from my alligator during, you know, just that was around 4 this afternoon. So
yeah, exactly. But you know, I think it's the same basic concept. Like the more erratically you move, like the less likely a predator is to sort of catch on to your movement pattern. And so I think that's another reason why, you know, again, makes them more annoying, but just another interesting evolutionary adaptation.
They're just trying to not get eaten by alligators.
Yeah. They just want to get to Aspen and start their summer vacation.
They're just trying to freaking get to Aspen and have their Aspen vacation without getting eaten by an alligator in Colorado. Yeah. You know, one of our many Colorado alligators.
Yes, the native Colorado alligator. So many of them.
There's a lot of them around. You have to be careful of those.
Yeah, you gotta watch out for those Colorado alligators.
They're real sneaky.
There is an alligator farm here in Colorado, and I've always wanted to go there. It's not like a farm for like alligator meat. I feel like it's not an actual farm. It's like a refuge. I think they like rescue alligators that people kept as pets and stuff. So yeah, I don't think it's that. I don't think it's that type of alligator farm.
Not that type of alligator.
It's, like, it's, you know, it's like an alligator you know, rescue.
Oh, okay.
That's better,
I guess.
I think. Well, I don't know.
I mean, maybe those people really do have to run from alligators like on a daily basis. I mean, I don't know.
I think, you know? They must. They must. You know? I think that's it for my mods here.
Yeah, good to know. Moths are weird.
They are. They're really weird.
Moths are weird. Weird. So my topic is something that I kind of stumbled across when I was researching the Titan submarine, which I think everyone at this point has probably heard about the Titan submarine. It was like that. It was like this little teeny tiny little like thing that was about the size of like a van. And this little submarine that someone, Ocean First or whatever the company was, that they had built like this little submarine, and they were like charging billionaires like $250,000 per person to like get in this little submarine that was then supposed to take them down to the Titanic wreckage. Mm-hmm. And I guess this little submarine like had, you know, it had done like a couple of voyages down to the Titanic and like had been successful and stuff. But then this last one that happened, the submarine collapsed and imploded, and everyone on all 5 people on board were just like instantly killed. And it was kind of a big deal because like they had all of these people, like the Coast Guard and, you know, like entities that were like searching for this submarine that was had stopped communicating and like just went missing. So eventually they did find it, and yeah, it was imploded and all of the people were dead. I don't know if they actually ever found like human remains. I never heard
that. Well, remember there's a bunch of, yeah, and Amy and I, we were like all over this.
Oh, we were like so obsessed.
We had all these conversations about like, it could go one of 2 ways, either like kind of the best death possible or like the worst death possible. You could either like suffocate in your own, like, you know, feces basically, because you know you've just been in there like, you know, like trapped in this like pod and your oxygen is running out and you're terrified and you just kind of like slowly suffocate to death, or you implode so quickly that you barely even felt anything. Yeah. You know, or truly before you could even feel, because the nerves wouldn't even be able to react that fast. So we had a lot of discussions about that, like, oh, it could go 2 ways.
Yeah,
but then remember there's a bunch of those articles saying, oh yeah, like presumed human remains have been found.
Yeah.
And then they never talked more about it, but our theory is it must have been a tooth.
It must have been. I mean, it could have been. There's like a bunch of different theories on what it was. I mean, if someone had, you know, if someone had like an artificial part of their body, like even like a filling or like a knee replacement, right, or you know, something like that, like that probably would have survived because it would be metal. Yeah. And then, you know, and then you could like kind of match that up and be like, oh yeah, this like came out of a human. But I mean, right, yeah,
it probably was a filling. I feel like that would make the most sense.
Or even like a wedding ring, you know, like I'm, you know,
would
like
you be able to call that human remains though? Cause like that's still, it's like attached to you.
The other thing that I, you know, that I think a lot of people had floated the theory that maybe they did actually find like some flesh that had been lodged in like a piece of like the ship that had imploded or something like that. But we don't really know because they never came out and like told us what it was that they found. So who fucking knows? I mean, we don't know. We just know that everyone is dead.
Yes. May they rest in peace.
Yeah, rest in peace.
The only one I felt bad about was the kid. The other people on that ship were all just impulsive, rich idiots. I do feel bad for the kid, and I feel bad for the mom. I feel bad for that kid.
I do feel bad, like, that, you know, five people are dead. That is, like, that is horrible. But, also, you know, like, maybe don't get inside, like, a very tiny submarine and try to go that deep into the ocean.
Just seems like
a risky thing to begin with. So
when there's plenty of fantastic documentaries about the Titanic and movies about it that show plenty of footage, you know,
just watch those online.
Yeah, it's all, you know, you don't need to leave the comfort of your home to experience what it looks like.
Just look at some pictures on the internet.
Yeah,
but anyway, so because of that, you know, just I've been doing research into like what does happen, like if you have this like massive shift in pressure, especially like within like an ocean type, you know, environment. Because I was actually surprised when they finally came out and they were like, oh, we found the remains of the sub, but we really haven't, you know, like there's no, like what happened to the people? You know?
Yeah.
Like, because it was only like a couple of days later that they found the sub remains. They found like the pieces of the sub, and I thought that there would be bodies. I thought that there would at least be pieces of bodies, but as far as I know, they really never found anything like significant to say like, like it wasn't like they found like an arm or like a leg or, you know, like I thought that they would at least find something, and there was just like nothing. And so I was also kind of, you know, I was like, what happens to your body when you go through something like that? What happens to your body when you just have like a massive shift in pressure, like so within a couple of seconds? So that was when I stumbled upon the incident that happened with the Byford Dolphin diving bell. And that's kind of what I'm gonna talk about today. Like, trigger warning, it gets very morbid and everyone is dead. So if you're not into that, like, turn back now. Do not keep listening. Right.
Yeah. But also, if you're not into that, why are you listening to this podcast?
But, yeah, because... exactly. but yeah, it's, it was a very sad story. Like, everyone dies at the end. And, but it was a very good lesson in like what happens to the human body when there's just like a massive shift in pressure. So this also both of these things go along with my most favorite chemical equation, which is PivNERT. Yes. If you are in college and you are studying PivNERT and PV equals NRT, hit us up, because I will talk about PivNERT all day long. I love it. I think it's like the most fun chemical equation that you can work with. It's like, it's so straightforward. Pressure times volume equals number of moles times R constant times temperature. Love it. It's so fascinating, and it applies to so many situations. So, but yeah, this is one of those situations where it applies in like kind of like a tragic, very sad way. So the Byford Dolphin incident was when you do like ocean drilling, like in the like deep sea drilling, there's people that have to go down there and like maintain those drilling rigs, right? So how they get those people down there is really interesting. They put them in what they call a diving bell, which is essentially like, it's like a little, it's just like a little chamber. They then lower into the ocean, and then the divers like go out and like fix whatever they need to fix and go back in the diving bell and they go back to the surface. Now, when you're that far underwater, the pressure is like immense. Like, so, so here at the surface, at here, at, like at the level of the ocean, we have one atmosphere of pressure. And a lot of these guys that do these like these maintenance things where they have to go down in these diving bells, they have to be able to withstand 9 atmospheres of pressure. So 9 times the pressure that we have here like at sea level. Okay. So how they do that is over like several weeks, they basically, they put these people into this chamber that's at sea level. And then they very slowly increase the pressure over several days up to 9 atmospheres.
Oh, wow.
And they be, and that's, they have to do it, and you have to do it very slowly because the body has to be able to like consolidate its gases and like just get, basically get used to having all this pressure on the body. And you can totally, if you do it slowly, you can totally live like that, which like, again, blows my mind. It's just like, that's crazy to me. So and these guys, it's such a dangerous job and it's such an uncomfortable job because they put them in like these little teeny tiny little rooms that they have to live in for basically a month. But the paycheck, they, in order to do this, if you're going to do this, like these guys were getting paid like $30,000 to $45,000 to do 1 month of that. So it's like pretty significant, you know, like, I mean, you can work a couple months out of the year and, you know, make your living that doing that, but it's very uncomfortable. And like, you're in this very pressurized, very small, like chamber, essentially. It's like a little, it would be like living in a van. you know, like living in a van.
They can't leave at all. Like they have to spend the entire, it's not like they're going there for 10 hours a day and then they get eat in there, sleep in there.
Eat and sleep and poop in there the whole time. Yeah. Okay. The entire time because the, just the change in pressure, it has to be done so slowly that they basically go in, they undergo this like pressurization for several days, and then they have to stay at that pressurization until the end of their work month, where they slowly then depressurize them and then they can walk out into the world.
Okay. So if they were to leave early without the, you know, slow build back into normal pressure, they would they get the bends? Is that the same that you get?
So yeah, so it would be very similar to getting the bends. Like and actually that's what happens is they that's why like this whole thing happened is because someone depressurized them in the proper procedure and then everyone died. So when you're a diver and you go down into the ocean and you have all this pressure pushed onto you, things like the gases in your blood, like we have gas in our bloodstream that is actively gas, but when you have that much pressure, like the gas starts getting pushed into things like your tissues and stuff like that. And then if you don't slowly release the pressure, the gases just like come rushing out in this way that makes you really sick and can potentially like cause you to, could potentially be fatal if you do it too fast.
Right.
But that's why people get the bends, is because if they go to the surface too quickly and they depressurize too quickly, these gases come out too fast and then it causes problems. So
yeah.
There were four divers, Edwin Coward, who's 35, Roy Lucas, who is 38, Bjorn Bergerson, who's 29, and Truls Hellerich, who's 34. I'm sure I'm trying butchering some of those names. I think that's like,
when was this? What year?
This was in 1983.
Okay.
And then there were these two guys who they called the diving bell tenders, who are outside of the rig, and they're the ones that are like controlling the pressurization and like the outside of the rig. And that was William Crammond and Martin Saunders. So these four guys are living, you know, inside this little area, basically. And the way it works is like, there's like a little living area. And then there was a little like tube that was kind of like a hallway that branched off of the living area. And then there was the diving bell on the other end of that little hall. And when I say hall, I mean, it's really like a tube. Like it was like, it's like barely big enough for you to squeeze your body through.
Okay.
So it's not like a spacious environment at all. It's just like, it's literally like a little like pipe that they're like squeezing their body.
This is no vacation in Aspen.
This is not a vacation in Aspen. The moths would hate it here. Right. So basically they would live in the little living area. And then every once, you know, whenever they needed to go down into the ocean, they would go through the little tube and they would get in the diving bell. And then they would go down into the ocean. They'd come back up and they would go back through the little tube and back into the living area. So when they didn't need when nobody was in the diving bell, they would disconnect the diving bell, like from the little hall. Mm-hmm. And so then inside the hallway, it was just open to the outside world and would have just one atmosphere of pressure. So there are like doors on each end, and the doors would seal off the diving bell in the living quarters so that the pressure, you know, wasn't disturbed in those areas. So basically what happened was on November 5th of 1983, Bjorn and Truls were inside the diving bell coming up from 80 meters.
Oh God.
So they were at like 9 atmospheres of pressure. So they come up, the tenders, William and Martin, attach the diving bell to the little hallway tube. And at that point, what they have to do is they have to pressurize the tube so that the tube is also at 9 atmospheres. Mm-hmm. So that when they come out of the diving bell, they're still, you know, in the same amount of pressure. So they pressurized the tube, Bjorn and Truls went through the tube into the living quarters. And then what they're supposed to do is they close the bell of the door of the diving bell, between the diving bell and the little tube. They close the door and then they actually increase the pressure within the diving bell just a little bit to make sure the door seals closed. Mm-hmm. And then they very slowly decrease the pressure within the little hallway tube, the little hallway pipe. They decrease that very slowly to 1 atmosphere, and then they take the diving bell off.
Okay.
So that's what is supposed to happen. And this entire time, there's another door that connects the living quarters and the little tube part, the little hallway tube. There's a door there that's supposed to be sealed so that so the living quarters remains at 9 atmospheres of pressure.
Okay.
So nobody totally knows what happened, but someone fucked up.
Yes.
Somebody fucked up. Whether it was like one of the tenders on the outside or whether it was one of the guys on the inside, like nobody knows. But basically what happened was Bjorn and Truls, they got back inside the living quarters. They were starting to close the door, which is a circle. It's like a little circular door. Mm-hmm. And somehow somebody on the outside disconnected the bell and exposed the tube to the outside world, to the outside pressure.
Oh no.
And it first of all, it instantly killed all 4 of the people that were inside the living quarters. Mm-hmm. 3 of the guys were like, I guess, lying down. And then Hellerich was close enough to the open door that he actually got sucked through the opening that was there. They said it was a 22 inch opening. As the living quarters depressurized from 9 atmospheres to 1 atmosphere very quickly, he got sucked out through. It was basically like a little, like a crescent shape, because like if you're imagining like a circular door, you know, it was closing, partially open about 22 inches at the widest part. And he got sucked through that opening as the living quarters depressurized. If you Google this, fair warning.
Google with warning.
There are pictures of Hellerich's body that are
okay. Horrific. I'll Google it, but I'm not going to show it in the video. I'm going to just react.
Yeah, I mean, it's they did find most of his body, and they were able to kind of piece it back together. And there are pictures of it online that are. Yeah, they are gnarly. Like, I mean, the guy's sludge, you know? I mean, the guy is, yeah, it's horrible. The other three guys, they were far enough away from the door that they didn't get sucked out. But essentially, because, they got the bends, like, to a fatal extent, because the nitrogen in their blood, the gases that, you know, had absorbed into the tissues came out so fast that basically their bodies were like boiled. They were dead instantly.
Was there anything left of them, or that was so traumatic that there wasn't even
all three of those bodies were recovered intact, and they actually the bodies didn't look terrible. But they're all dead.
Okay.
On the outside, the pressure change from 9 atmospheres to 1 atmosphere through the diving bell off of the little hallway tube. And essentially, like, it crushed one of the tenders on the outside. I think it was Crammond. Was instantly killed from the force of the diving bell, like being essentially thrown off of the hall. And then Saunders was actually found alive with the diving bell on top of him.
Wow.
Did he live? I can't remember now. He was fucked up though. Like, he was very injured. Yeah.
I would imagine so.
But yeah, Crammond died. All four of the guys inside died pretty much instantly as soon as the diving bell was taken off, and the pressure just like depressurized so fast that it essentially just killed everybody, like instantaneously. Just,
yeah,
from the pressure of, you know, having all this pressure to having basically no pressure.
Yeah. There was no gradual lead up. There was no transition, yeah. All the things that they're supposed to have.
Yeah. So everyone basically dies. And there were like a couple of like theories on like why did this happen, you know, like did Crammond, because Crammond was the one that had disconnected the diving bell before it was ready to be disconnected. And so it was kind of like, was there just a miscommunication where Crammond like thought that they were all good and then he disconnected it? Was there a failure in you know, one of the clamps or one of the seals or something like that? Like, was it actually nobody's fault and it was just faulty hardware? Yeah. So keep in mind too, that these guys typically worked more than 12-hour days. It took longer than 12 hours to get the guys into the diving bell and then down to the bottom of the ocean and then have them do their thing and then back up to the top. So these guys were very routinely working more than 12-hour days for a month straight.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, there's a lot of very tired, tired people very dangerous equipment.
We get it. Not that we're in charge of, well, I was going to say not that we're in charge of the life or death of people, but you are.
I'm not. Occasionally. I try not to be, but you know.
Typically not too much past the 12-hour mark of, although you do often work 12-hour shifts.
Yeah, I do work 12-hour shifts, but yeah.
So, you know, they think, okay, maybe they didn't, the timing was just off, they didn't communicate it, or maybe something was wrong with the actual hardware itself. Yeah. Does anyone think that it was intentional that he tried to kill them, no, or have they ruled that out?
I think they kind of ruled that out just because, like, I mean, I don't know, it wouldn't really make any sense for him to, like,
try to murder everybody, especially because like the thing, the way that he would have done it would be like so dangerous that he almost assuredly would have died himself too, which he did. Right. You know, I mean, he did die. So
true. Okay. Okay.
So, you know, it wasn't, there wasn't any like foul play that was suspected. It was just kind of like, but it was, you know, there is a big question about, you know, why did he detach the diving bell before it was pressurized correctly? And this was a thing that he had done, you know, 100 times before, and like, why, you know, why, so why did this happen? And yeah, a lot of it was just kind of like, you know, they're really tired, and maybe the rig was like had a flaw, mm-hmm, that caused this to happen. So, mm-hmm, wow. So that's kind of like, that's basically the story of the incident. And yeah, I mean, when I looked at the pictures of Hellerich's body online, I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, they found a bunch of his internal organs that had gotten sucked out of him that were like meters away from the doorway. And there was like part of his like spine and his windpipe, part of his intestines that were still inside the living chambers. But he just got shredded by being too close to this door when the depressurization happened. So
wowza.
Yeah.
Did that happen quick enough that he probably hopefully didn't suffer? And it's,
yeah, like, I mean, very, very likely this happened within a matter of seconds.
Yeah.
Because I mean, when we think about, you know, like what pressurization means, right? I mean, we're talking about basically molecules that are just being like squeezed together.
Yeah.
Into a very small space. And that's what pressure is. So now you have all of these, like, even just like air molecules that are just bouncing around in a very small area. Whereas normally those molecules are used to just bouncing around in kind of, you know, an expansive amount of space. So yeah, when you're talking about, you know, depressurization and we're thinking about going from nine atmospheres of pressure down to one atmosphere of pressure.
Mm-hmm.
That's just like a huge difference. Mm-hmm. I read that it takes one day for the human body to acclimate to 9 atmospheres of pressure. It takes 4 days to decompress the human body.
It takes
4 times as long to decompress safely as it does to compress.
Okay. So this was the worst possible.
Yeah.
If they had been plunged down there really quickly, it maybe wouldn't have been as epic, but they probably would have died also. But wow. Okay. So if we're relating it to the Titan, submarine of more recent years here, allegedly it imploded and they were crushed or just like disintegrated. But did both of those things happen simultaneously? Did they, you know, have this massive pressure change where the gases were exchanged too quickly and also they were crushed by the implosion?
So it's an interesting comparison to talk about this, which is technically depressurization very quickly, as opposed to what happened with the Titan, which was pressurization very quickly. So, because essentially what we think happened with the Titan, nobody knows for sure, but there was some kind of little fault in the structure of the submarine that then caused the submarine to break apart and essentially like the entire weight of the ocean crushed these people. It is a little bit different, but I mean, the outcome's the same. Like, everyone dies. Like, the moral of the story is don't have massive changes of pressure on your body within a few seconds, or you will die.
Yes. Yes. As we all are
As we all are at some point during the day, having, you know, pressurization changes. But
yes. Although I feel much more sorry for the gentleman who died in the dolphin incident here, because, you know, they were just trying to do their jobs.
Yeah.
And they weren't just, you know, rich people who are trying to get this thrill without thinking it through.
Trying to fuck around at the bottom of the ocean.
Right. Panic. They were trying to fix some shit for us. Yeah. So
I read recently that they were thinking, because the Titan sub was it was also kind of interesting because it had been to the Titanic successfully on several missions before, and it had come back and you know, things were okay and nobody died. Mm-hmm. But I was reading recently that one of the theories is that there was actually like these little micro defects in some of like the materials that were made. Mm. So like when you make metals, like, or when you, you know, forge metals or whatever, there can be like little tiny imperfections in the, like, the structure of the metal. And mm-hmm. So now one of the theories is that maybe there was like these little, basically like micro defects that cause like little teeny tiny little bits of buckling over time, mm-hmm. like from previous voyages down to the Titanic. And right. And it just happened to be that it went through enough. It went through and kind of gathered up enough of these little teeny tiny little defects that all of a sudden it was, you know,
it hit the threshold.
It was like the straw that broke the camel's back, you know, type scenario where all of a sudden now the submarine is breaking in half and mm-hmm. everyone inside is dead.
Yep. Jeez. Well, yeah. Moral of the story, follow directions.
Yes.
Don't go to the depths of the ocean unless you absolutely have to. And if you have to, follow the protocol.
Yeah, definitely follow the protocol. And don't open doors that you're not supposed to open.
Yeah. That's just a good rule in general.
I mean, just a good rule in general, too. Yeah, that's true.
Oh, man. So do they still do, you know, underwater, you know, deep ocean kind of fixes?
I think they must. This method,
or do they have robots now? You know, it's been 40
that's
years.
That's a good question. I don't, I mean, I would assume that at, you know, because we have, you know, deep ocean drilling all over the world now in various places and for various reasons that, you know, somebody has to go down there and maintain, you know, those machines, right?
So, right.
I do think though that I read in a couple of places that the Byford dolphin incident helped with creating more laws in terms of regulations for like deep sea, like diving bell type things, mm-hmm. and that it helped, you know, make them safer and put more protocols in place so that things like this didn't happen.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Wow.
Yeah. It was actually the Byford dolphin. So this happened in, I said, 1983. The Byford dolphin rig was just recently decommissioned in 2016. So they kept using it. They kept using it, even though like this horrible, horrible thing had happened.
Yeah, can you imagine being the next crew of people to go down after this happened?
Yeah, like, I don't think that would be a job that I would be volunteering for. I definitely don't think I would be doing that job.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of how much money it would take me. I don't know if I ever would. Wow. I guess that shows like the importance of the work they were doing down there, because there was no alternative. The repairs had to be made. They had to keep working down there.
Yeah.
They couldn't just stop the whole operation. So,
but it does kind of, you know, it does kind of explain too, you know, why they're paying these guys, you know, $30,000 to $45,000 to do 1 month of work on this, because it's just, I mean, it's so dangerous and it's so uncomfortable. I mean, the little diving bell, like I looked at some pictures of it. I mean, it's literally like, you know, at the playground, you know, like you have like those little balls on the end of the playground, mm-hmm. like, you know, mm-hmm. like the little, and you go inside and there's like these little windows. It's like that. That's like what it's like being in there.
Yes, that's terrifying. And I go in those quite often.
Yeah.
You know, being the mother of a now 3-year-old, I am forced to go into these very often.
So yeah, jeez. Just imagine being inside one of those and like going down to the bottom of the ocean, and then you like get out and it's like pitch black down there also. I mean, it's just right. Like, it's like yeah. Nothing.
And I'm sure no like light. They're eating like, you know, freeze-dried, you know, that like,
oh yeah,
just sure the, all of the conditions down there sound miserable. Yeah, like just, you're yeah. You're in a tin can with 3 other people for a month, and
yeah. But when you get out, and hopefully you get out and without dying, and you know, and then you make 45 grams. So I don't know.
I feel like that's not that much. And granted, I guess that would be like it was 45 grand 40 years ago. Yeah, that would be obviously a lot more today. But at the same time, it's like I feel like you'd need to take a lot of time off after doing that. You wouldn't just like go back to your day job of working a 9-to-5 in the office right. after that. So you probably, so I don't know. I feel like comparatively to the risk of your life, I don't know, even feel like that's not even worth it.
I just, like, yeah, I don't know. I just, the conditions alone, like living in such a small area for a month, I don't even think I could do it. Like I would get to like day 3 and I'd be like, let me out.
I know.
I want to see the sun. Let me out of here.
Go to Aspen.
Yeah. I mean, imagine like, you get four grown men basically living in like the something that's like the size of a camper together. Like, can you imagine like the farts, man?
I know. Yeah.
Where and it's like fart?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Is there, where do they go to the bathroom? Is there just like a bucket down there?
And they did. There was some kind of like toilet facility in there. Okay. But yeah, I mean,
probably, I'm sure not the nicest though.
It's probably, yeah.
Or largest.
And I mean, like, you know, someone takes
and
a
it's
shit.
It's not like there's outdoor ventilation.
Yeah, there's nothing. There's no ventilation. You can't have ventilation or you'll die.
Yeah, so, that's exactly.
You know, someone, you know, like someone takes a really smelly shit and then, you know, y'all just get to like, y'all just get to sit in there with
stuck
it.
Stuck in there. Well, I know what career I won't be ever pursuing.
Yeah, I definitely.
In my lifetime.
Do not recommend it. I mean, personally, yeah, for me, like, I'm sure that there are other people that are like, oh yeah, that sounds great. I could totally do that. But
yeah, no. there's more thrill seeking people out there yeah. than us.
I don't even like, I don't even know if I would call it thrill, like a thrill. Like
that's it's true. It's more like endurance.
It sounds really fucking boring. Honestly.
That's true.
Like what do you like for a month? You're just like in this little camper sized, like little area and you just have to like stay in there.
And, I know. Like, it's not like they had, yeah. Like could any sort of I mean, obviously they had to have some communication because they were still kind of, well, how much communication yeah. could they have with the surface? Cause they had to communicate, you know,
yeah, so they did have some kind of communication. I'm assuming it was all like electronic communication, you know, like it wasn't like they were able to talk to each other or anything, you know.
No, there's no Netflix. Obviously, that was before.
I know. I'm like, man, 1983.
YouTube, that was before.
Like you don't even have like internet and like streaming services back
then.
I know. Like,
yeah, legitimately.
What do you do?
That was before Wi-Fi was a thing that existed.
I saw like a picture of, like the 4 guys like sitting in there and like, they were like playing chess or something.
Yeah. Like what else do you do?
Yeah. Like what else do you do? Like play some board games and be under a lot of pressure for a month.
Yep. Metaphorical and physical pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of pressure.
So yeah.
Well, I'm glad that that I went first and you went second, actually, because I feel like my nice little moth story
went
as well. I think this is a nice build up to it. Like,
yeah.
Here's some nice little facts about moths vacationing in Aspen.
Yeah. Here's a story of
how to have a series of pressure killing Corbin.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like that. The nice little facts about moths maybe would have hit different if I had gone first.
Yep. Oh man. Okay. Well, that was fascinating. Anything else to add about the dangers of the ocean?
No, I think
everything.
That was kind of it. I was like, it was really sad because some of the
some of like the videos and stuff that I watched about this, like all these, you know, cause all these guys were like relatively young, you know, they were like in their 30s, like the youngest guy was like 29, but most of them like were married and had kids. Mm-hmm. And so, and I was just like, ugh, that like hurts my soul a little.
Yeah, I know. I kind of hope their families didn't see the pictures of the postmortem.
Yeah. Oh, that would
remains. They probably had to.
Yeah, the pictures of Hellerich's remains that you can find online. I mean, it doesn't even look like a person. It's just like
pieces. Yeah, I looked at. Yeah, or it looks like a costume that you'd like put on or something. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
It really like it doesn't look human.
All right. Well, on that note, from mobs to dead bodies in the ocean. Thanks for joining us today on Weird the Podcast.
You can contact us on Instagram at weird.podcast.
Subscribe to us on YouTube, Weird the Podcast.
Or shoot us an email at thepodcastweird@gmail.com.
Thanks everyone. It's been weird. Okay, I think we are recording.
Record it.
Oh, I gotta get my... Oh, Titus.
Okay.
I know. He needs cognitive behavioral therapy.
He really does. Titus.
Do they have that for dogs? I guess that's just called dog training.
I guess that's just training.
Let's see. What else do I have on my list of... Math Fox. Wow. Moth facts.
Math Fox.